somebody shared one of these videos, the one from 2 weeks ago, lesson 137. They shared this video in the King James debate group, and somebody watched it, and they're like, "Ah, that lesson was too long, and you should have only, you only needed 10 minutes to cover that point." Okay, I mean, that's folks' opinion. This class is growing in size as far as who's here right now, so I'm just going to move forward and do what we think we need to do here. So lesson 139, the Bishop's Bible, understanding the scope and process of the project. So introduction point one. Last week in lesson 138, we studied the religious context of the Elizabethan age as a backdrop for understanding the factors that gave rise to the Bishop's Bible. Recall that Elizabeth's desire to walk a, quote, middle way between the High Church Anglicans and the Puritans spilled over into a discussion about the Bible itself. After originally supporting the Geneva Bible, Archbishop Matthew Parker came to believe that a new translation was necessary that was devoid of the Calvinistic marginal notes that endeared the Geneva Bible to the Puritan faction. In this lesson, we want to look at the person of Archbishop Parker and understand the scope and process of his project to replace the Geneva Bible with a new translation that the bishops of the Anglican Church could support. So I have located online and downloaded the PDF copy of a 1568 Bishop's Bible. So I'll have some stuff to say later on when we look at the contents of this Bible, but this is the title page from 1568. And this, there's an image here of Queen Elizabeth right on the title page. So there's some more to say about this that we'll get to later on. But again, I've pulled this off the internet for free and have access to the whole thing. So very few of these Bibles you're not able to somehow find or locate. Now, obviously, finding one in print, I've not been able to do that, and I have my own hard copy, which I wish I could, but obviously that's not happening. How many remember 2 weeks ago when I brought in that New Testament octapla that had the eight translations in it? That does have in that a 1602 copy of the Bishop's New Testament, but this is the original Bishop's Bible from 1568 that we can look at digitally, and I will be showing you some things about that later on. For now, I'm just going to kind of leave that there, sort of a placeholder as we go through this. So let's look at the main point here. Archbishop Matthew Parker and the Bishop's Bible. Point one. Professor David Daniel offers the following biographical information regarding Archbishop Parker in The Bible in English, Its History and Influence. He says, quote, so he's talking about Parker here. He was licensed to preach in 1533 and became Anne Boleyn's, Elizabeth's mother, so the Anne Boleyn was Queen Elizabeth's mother, chaplain in 1535. So, interestingly enough, Elizabeth, her archbishop, initially, was Archbishop Matthew Parker. The same guy that was the chaplain to her mother when Henry VIII was still alive. Okay? So, he, as we're going to see, he's going to escape Mary, the wrath of Queen Mary, the Catholic queen, by basically living in hiding. He doesn't leave England, but he goes and hides out and lives in hiding for 5 or 6 years while she's in charge to escape her hunting down all of the Protestant bishops and what have you. Okay? So look at still in the quote now, next sentence. In 1544, he was made Master of Corpus Christi College, Cambridge, and Dean of Lincoln in 1552. He supported Lady Jane Grey in 1533, and then lived in hiding until Mary died in 1558. So just a quick point. When it says there that he supported Lady Jane Grey, when Henry VIII died, there was controversy over who would succeed him to the throne. Okay? And Edward, his son, was the immediate successor, but as we already know, Edward was not very healthy and he died very young. When Edward died, there was now this question of succession of who was going to be the next heir. Okay? Part of the reason for that is Henry has a ton of different, he has a series of daughters. One of them was Mary the First, another one is Queen Elizabeth, right? And they're half sisters because they have the same dad. But there was a controversy after Edward died about who would be the heir to the throne. There were some that supported this Lady Jane Grey as the replacement to Edward. This Archbishop Matthew Parker, he's one of those people. So when it becomes clear that Mary is going to be the queen, this guy has to go into hiding for two reasons, all right? Number one, he's a Protestant, and she could very easily, like, hunt him down. But second, he supported this other woman to be the queen. So Mary was obviously not pleased about that, all right? So there's a few different layers there, some subtext that I just throw out for you to just sort of understand. Next sentence. Elizabeth made him Archbishop of Canterbury in December 1559. He received convocation and through it published the 39 articles, and he was soon embroiled in his own vestarian, that's a fancy word for vestments or liturgical dress. So one of the issues that the Puritans had with the Anglican Church is they didn't like the Anglican bishops and Anglican churchmen dressing in the vestments. You know what I'm talking about? You know, the liturgical vestments where you wear the collar and the robe and this and that, right? So the Puritans didn't like any of all that stuff. So when it's talking about a vestarian controversy, that's what it's talking about, an argument over whether or not the clergy should be wearing the vestments of the church. Of course, the Puritans said no because it smacked of Catholicism and they didn't like that, okay? He was soon embroiled in his own vestarian vestments or liturgical dress controversy, becoming increasingly anti-Puritan. He died in 1575. His library remains a glory of Corpus Christi College, Cambridge. Last week in lesson 138, while looking at the Elizabethan context that gave rise to the Bishop's Bible, we observed the following regarding Archbishop Matthew Parker from the pen of Donald L. Bray. Quote, Archbishop Matthew Parker initially supported the reading of the Geneva Bible, but later, as he became more anti-Calvinistic, he began to support a new translation. He saw the success of the Geneva Bible as an attack on the authority of the bishops. All religious authorities universally condemned Tyndale's version. Since Coverdale's translation and the Great Bible were not translated from the original languages, they were considered inferior. The widespread popularity accorded the Geneva Bible after 1560 did not include the majority of the clergy in the Church of England. Although they recognized the superiority of the translation, the Calvinistic notes were offensive. Recognizing the inadequacies of the Great Bible, someone suggested an official translation be undertaken that could complete the task previously given to Coverdale. So, let me translate all that for you. The Bishop's Bible is now going to be a move amongst the Anglican bishops to revise the Great Bible and create a competitor for the Geneva Bible. Because they recognize that the Geneva Bible is superior to the Great Bible in terms of its translation, that is the biblical text itself, but they do not like the marginal notes that are in the Geneva Bible. So this is now going to be a move amongst the church bishops now to do something about that, and that is going to ultimately result in the Bishop's Bible. Okay? Anybody got any questions so far? No? Okay. Page 2. Likewise, from Blackford Condit, we read the following in lesson 138, quote, the progress of this and other moral reforms during the time of Elizabeth are traceable directly to the influence of the English Bible. Since 1526, the New Testament had been scattered broadcast among the people. Since 1535 and 1537, there had been no lack of the Holy Scriptures in the mother tongue. To the praise of Queen Elizabeth, be it said that during her reign, people were free to print, circulate, and read the Bible as their conscience dictated. There was an edition of Cranmer's Bible, 1540, published during this reign, but the Geneva Bible was in the greatest demand. Copies here, or something, there's a word missing, of the New Testament and the Geneva Version, also of Tyndale's translation, were printed and put into circulation. In all of this, the people were satisfied, but the bishops were ill at ease. very soon after the ascension of Elizabeth, they set themselves about publishing a new version of the Bible. The result of this undertaking was the Bishop's Bible of 1568. So again, this is the title page from a 1568 Bishop's Bible. All sources report that Archbishop Matthew Parker was the driving force behind the creation of the Bishop's Bible. Conant states the following regarding the matter, quote, "Matthew Parker, Bishop of Canterbury, was the leader of this enterprise. Among his reasons for setting forth a new version was that the copies of the Great Bible were so scarce that it was impossible to supply the churches. Notwithstanding, a new edition of the Great Bible was published in 1562, also in 1566. Another reason that these Bibles were, quote, very faultily printed." So in other words, they had a lot of what? Errors and mistakes and stuff in the way they were printed. "He might have added still another to the effect that he hoped by putting forth a new version to supersede the Genevan Bible, which was becoming more and more popular with the people, and which was most distasteful to the Archbishop on account of it being the representative of Puritanism and nonconformity. Though the Archbishop was a scholar, a liberal patron of learning, and a man of unquestioned piety, yet he was also thoroughly attached to the Queen's polity of reducing the number of clergy to one way of thinking and acting, that he had little sympathy with anything that stood in the way of conformity to the new ecclesiastical regulations." Okay? So, Archbishop Parker, the Archbishop under Queen Elizabeth, who had also been the personal chaplain to her mother, Queen Anne Boleyn, while she was alive, is very supportive of this middle way policy that the Queen is setting forth. And so they view this Bishop's Bible as a way forward to correct the Great Bible, the last officially Anglican-approved Bible, to correct its errors and mistakes, make it more widely available, and offer an alternative to the ever-increasing popularity of the Geneva Bible. So is everybody kind of understanding or following why these bishops are thinking that they need to do yet another translation? It's all related. A lot of it is, again, related to the politics of the situation and what is happening in England at the time. Later in the same chapter, Condon adds, quote, "So far as Archbishop Parker was the prime mover of this work, the Bible is rightly designated as Parker's Bible. Sometimes it is called Queen Elizabeth's Bible, not for any part taken by her in furthering their enterprise, but simply on account of its being the only new revised edition of the Bible done in England during her reign. But the most significant name is that of the Bishop's Bible, so called for the active cooperation of the bishops in the work of revision. The work began in 1563, 1564, and was not completed until 1568. So, Elizabeth takes the throne in 1558. By 1563, so within 5 years, is her archbishop moving on this project to make yet another translation of the English Bible. Okay? So again, any questions or comments about any of that? So, page 3. "According to Dr. Brake, the project began in 1563 and included the following bishops. Quote, in 1563, a massive translation project was launched and Archbishop Parker was selected as the chief editor. The following men were given the task to complete the various parts of the Bishop's Bible: William Allen, Bishop of Exeter; R. Davies, Bishop of St. David's; E. Sandys, Bishop of Worcester; A. Pearson, Canon of Canterbury; A. Pren, Canon of Ely; R. Horn, Bishop of Winchester; T. Bentham, Bishop of Lichfield; E. Grindle, Bishop of London; J. Parkhurst, Bishop of Norwich; R. Cox, Bishop of Ely again; Guest, Bishop of Rochester; G. Goodman, Dean of Westchester; and Giles Lawrence, Professor of Greek at Oxford. So you have a handful of what? Maybe, I didn't count them, but maybe somewhere between probably around 10-ish bishops who are going to be involved in this. Okay, so all of these are bishops for officials within the Anglican Church. So you see a contrast there between these guys and these Geneva exiles who translated the Bible in Geneva, Switzerland, living in hiding. So here we have a listing of the different bishops. Okay. When the project was finished, Archbishop Parker, whose health was failing, presented a copy of the Bishop's Bible to Queen Elizabeth via her Secretary of State, William Cecil. The Bible was accompanied by a letter of explanation dated October 5, 1568. Contained within the letter, among other things, was a breakdown of the bishops who worked on the project along with their respective assignments. J.I. Mombert has reproduced this information in his 1883 book, English Versions of the Bible, as the following screenshots from pages 268 and 269 will attest. So if you go to page 4, and I'm going to switch this out for the benefit of people watching at home, we're looking at this list. We're looking at this list right here. So what you're looking at here is a... So this is the contents of what was in this letter that the Archbishop sent to Queen Elizabeth's Secretary of State as far as the breakdown on the project, all right? So according to this, the sum of the Scripture, the table of Christ line, the argument of Scripture, the preface in the Psalter, and the preface in the New Testament, who was responsible for that? Matthew Parker, Archbishop of Canterbury, okay? Genesis or Exodus was also assigned to who? Parker. Leviticus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy are Pearson. Then we have this Deuteronomy by Edgion, which are also known as Ali in the list. Then you've got the breakdown there of Joshua through part of the Apocrypha. So you look at some of that, and it might look a little bit weird to you because some of it is related to the Apocrypha. But you can see here, the bottom line here is, was the Bible subdivided into chunks and then a chunk given to each bishop to be responsible for that particular section? All right? So that's the methodology or the conception that Parker is using here. And if you really allow your eye to run down that list, who, by far and away, did most of the work, or the majority of the work? It was Parker himself. So Parker does all the front material at the beginning, according to this list. So that would be this stuff here at the top. Parker is responsible for Genesis through Exodus. He's responsible for Matthew and Mark section. And then he's also responsible for the majority of the Pauline epistles and Hebrews, according to the listing here of what Parker is responsible for. So the project is his idea. It's set up the way that he conceived to set it up. And who is doing, I don't want to say all the work, but the vast majority of the work, the greatest load of the work is being done by who? By Parker himself, okay? Now, there's something I want to point out to you here. So what he's doing is he breaking the project up into smaller chunks and then assigning those smaller chunks to specific bishops. So when it came time later on for the King James, did the King James translators under the leadership Richard Bancroft, that's the name, Bancroft, what do? Do they break up the Bible into sections and then assign sections to specific companies of translators? So my point in bringing that out to you is the process that the King James translators use in a lot of ways is going to be an improvement over a process that was first used by who? By Parker. Now, hands down, without question, the King James process is superior because each company did a section and then they checked each other's work and then they had a general meeting at the end. All right? does not appear to be that that's what happened with the bishop's Bible. The bishop's Bible was, you know, subdivided between the different bishops, and then they just sort of did their own work, and then it was kind of all just then published together as a, you know, as what would ultimately become the bishop's Bible. But the idea of the process that the King James translators would ultimately use, you can kind of see the beginnings of that idea with what Parker is doing here with the bishop's Bible. So anybody got any questions about that before we go to page 5?
How many were working with the bishops individually when it says, you know, a particular bishop did this section of the Bible? Were there 10 people with him, or were there...
My understanding of that question, Bart, is that it was largely them.
So just them.
Just them, and maybe like a secretary or something like that, but there was not...
Not a lot.
There was not like a huge company of men that were working under the leadership of a given bishop. The bishops were just doing it. They're doing their assigned section by themselves.
And then when they brought it back together, did they kind of vote on it, or how they?
There's no evidence that they had any kind of a general meeting type of process. Mm-hmm. So let's just let's at random talk about. This section here on Acts and Romans that was done by Cox. Cox would have just done it and turned it into Parker. And then Parker would have included his work with the work of everyone else, and then when he had everyone's work done, he just would have printed the bishop's Bible. So it was not done with the same level of, care, if you want to use that word, that the King James would later be done with. But the idea of taking the whole Bible and subdividing it into different sections and then assigning specific people that section, that idea would later grow into the company process that the King James translators ultimately used. So you can see sort of the seeds of that idea here in what we're looking at. Yeah.
Was it according to their profession and their skill and their background of knowing that those certain books?
I would like to say the answer to that is yes, but ultimately I don't know. Because next Sunday, in our next lesson, we're going to look at the Old Testament. And we're going to see that there's not a ton of original work in their Old Testament. And when there is original work, the original work is not necessarily great. So I don't think that that Archbishop Parker is sitting down and saying, okay, well, Cox is an expert on Paul or the Acts period history, so I'm going to give him that. There does not appear to be any evidence that that's what happened. So in other words, that folks were assigned specific sections based upon an expertise in that section, that does not seem to be the case. Mm-hmm. All right? Let's go to page 5.
Do the bishops work mostly dealing with the notes that they add or delete, or
mostly dealing with their revision of the Great Bible
translation?
Yeah.
Oh, really? Okay.
Which we'll say a little bit more about later on. Look at page 5. At Archbishop Parker's suggestion, the initials of each bishop responsible for a given section of the revision were added to the text. This was done so that the revisers, quote, might be more diligent and answerable for their doings. So this is kind of a perceived accountability measure, so that people would know who was responsible for a given section, right? That said, the initials found in the text, as noted by Monbert below, do not match the list on the image. Okay? So here's the problem. He's got all this laid out here, but when you compare what's actually the initials that are actually in the bishop's Bible, they don't match the way that the project had been initially conceived. So there's a lot of things about, there's some things about this that don't seem to follow and that don't make a lot of sense. So that said, the initials found in the text as noted by Monbert below do not match the list, see images on page 3, presented to William Cecil in the letter dated October 5, 1568. So if you look at this, This is the list of the initials found at the end of different sections of the bishop's Bible. If you take the names here and the initials that are found and compare them against the names in this list, they're not the same. So somewhere along the line, something happened to create some discrepancies about this. And to my knowledge, according to everything that I've read on this, no one really has been able to figure out what happened. Now years after the fact.
Are they not the same at all, or just?
No, some of them are the same.
Okay.
But there are some initials and names that don't match the list.
The first list was probably the plan.
Right. That's what I would.
List.
Yeah. And even with the King James, they start this. The Bishop's Bible, they start this in 1563, and the thing's not done until 1568. Is that a lot of time during which things can change? Yeah. So I think that's probably the most charitable explanation, is that this list here represents what the original plan was, and the initials in this, at the end of each section, so this would be the list here, and then this would be the initials of what actually happened, based upon, because a lot of different things can happen here. Same thing happened with the King James. Okay, the King James is done between 1604 and 1611. Some of the original men that were a part of the project in 1604 literally died before the thing was done. So you have a lot of time here where you could have a lot of different variables enter, which could explain. So to Mike's point, I think that's probably the most charitable explanation of why the names recorded here don't match exactly with all of the names that are on the list. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Could that also maybe point to the fact that they did have a gathering after the initial?
It's certainly possible. It's certainly possible that they had some sort of a general meeting. Although we don't, there's nothing that I've read that suggests that as part. Because in a minute we're going to look at the rules that he set up for this, and there's nothing listed in there about any of that. So let's look at the next point, and I want to show you what I'm talking about. The following is an image taken from the end of the Pentateuch. Following the book of Deuteronomy, note the initials W.E. for William Allen. Okay, so let me show you for those who are watching at home. So this is the end of the book of Deuteronomy, and do you see the initials W.E.?
That's the way they made a W?
That was a W, yeah. So this is the initials of William Allen. And you say, well, why is it not an A? It's related to the spelling and so on and so forth. But then notice what they said. The end of the first book, the end of the fifth book of Moses, called the Hebrew, whatever that says in Hebrew, and in Latin, Deuteronomy. So there are the initials. So if you go up and compare that now with this, we see William Alley as listed after the end of the Pentateuch. So the insertion of these initials into the text at the end of a given section was a conceived accountability measure to sort of hold that particular bishop accountable, I guess, in a way, for the accuracy of their translation. So if you don't like it or whatever, you think it's wrong, or that you think they made a mistake, you need to talk to who? You need to talk to this guy. Okay? Any other questions right now? Okay. Let's go to page 6. So here's kind of a little bit of an explanation, although it's probably not totally sufficient, but the list appended to Archbishop's letter of 5 October 1568 is no doubt inaccurate. Regarding this, Mombert notes, it is known that Giles Lawrence, whose initials do not occur anywhere, took a large share in the revision. According to Lewis, he and other critics were employed by the Archbishop to pursue the old translation and diligently compare it with the original text. So, Bart, if there was like a general editor, it would have been this guy, this Lawrence guy, who was a professor of Greek and Hebrew at Oxford. So if there was somebody that who had the responsibility of kind of comparing what they had with, say, the Hebrew and Greek texts, it would have been this guy here. So the first Bishop's Bible comes out, as we already have noted up here on the board, it comes out in 1568. There's going to be a revision of it in 1572. The 1572 revision is largely due to recommendations that this Lawrence guy is going to make as he reviews it. Okay? So, included in Parker's letter was a subjoined memorandum titled Observations Respected of the Translators, which set forth the rules or directions to be followed by the translators. The rules read as follows. So we'll look at each one of these. First, to follow the common English translation used in the churches and not to recede from it, but where it varieth manifestly from the Hebrew or Greek original. So, what would have been the common English Bible used in the churches that they're going to be revising? It would have been the Great Bible. Okay? So, clearly, according to Rule 1, the Bishop's Bible is going to be a revision of what? The Great Bible. You guys following that? So, they're to follow the Great Bible, then, unless they determine that the Hebrew or the Greek would necessitate that something be changed to make it more what? More accurate. You guys following that? Item, to use sections and divisions in the text as Pagan in his translation uses, for the variety of the Hebrew to follow the said Pagan and Munster especially, and generally others learned in tongues. So, what that's getting at is dividing the text into chapters and what?
Verses.
Now, that's a really long-winded way of saying it, but that's what they're essentially saying there, right? To divide it into sections. Notice he says sections and divisions in the text. Now we know that the Geneva Bible was the first Bible to do that in English, first English Bible to do that, but that had been done previous in other languages by Pagan and Munster. Okay?
Was that done just to make it easier to study the Bible?
Largely, yeah. Look at the next item. Watch. To make no bitter notes upon the text, or yet to set down any determination in places of controversy. Okay? So, what is that point getting at?
Marginal
notes. And remember, one of Parker's main objections to the Geneva Bible was what? The marginal notes. So here he is saying, don't make any bitter notes upon the text. And notice what else it says. Or you have to set down any determination in places of controversy. So if there is a controversial passage or verse, were they supposed to say what they thought the interpretation was or leave it alone?
Leave it alone.
Leave it alone. All right? Next item. To note such chapters and places as contain matter of genealogies or other such places not edifying with some strike or note that the reader may eschew them in his public reading. What does that mean?
Don't ignore the genealogies.
No, I think it means here you mark the text with places where there's nothing edifying in this chapter, in this section, so you don't have to read it in public. That's what it means. So it's, I read that one, I'm like, whoa. So you're saying there's certain places that aren't edifying? I'm not sure, that seems a little presumptuous to me, but that's what the rule says. So in other words, in a public reading, do you want to be reading so-and-so begat so-and-so, who begat so-and-so, who begat so-and-so, who begat so-and-so, who begat so-and-so? According to him, he's saying, you don't need to read that in public, so mark that as something that doesn't need to be read in public. That's what he's getting at. Again, I'm not saying I agree with it, but I'm saying that's what the rule was.
Maybe he just had a hard time with names.
Maybe. I mean, maybe he's like me. And all right.
Yeah, that's good.
And then let's look at the last rule, that all such words as sound in the old translation to any offense of lightness or obscurity be expressed with more convenient terms and phrases. What did I say?
Obscurity.
I'm sorry, let me read that again. I did read that wrong. That all such words as sound in the old translation to any offense or lightness or obscenity be expressed with more convenient terms and phrases. I have to be honest with you, I don't totally understand what he's driving at there.
Like this is
I guess stuff like that, I guess, that you could argue, you know, doesn't sound nice. You remember when we were looking at that example? Remember when we were looking at the Geneva Bible and we had that whole conversation about what it means to cover his feet?
Yeah.
To do his easement, you know, it said that in the margin and all that stuff, right? And then we looked at other places where the Geneva uses the word pisseth and stuff like that. So I don't really know if that's what they're getting at here or what, but I think there's, you know, three or four pretty clear principles here that they want to use, that Parker wants to use. Number one, they're to follow what Bible? The Great Bible. They're to have the chapter and verse divisions. They're to make no bitter notes upon the text or explain hard places. They're to mark off genealogies and sections deemed not edifying in public reading. And then there's this kind of hard one here that's not real clear exactly what they mean. All right. Now, I want to say one more thing, though, about this list before we go on. So, Parker, in my estimation, so this is my personal opinion, obviously, folks are free to disagree with it if they want to. But when Richard Bancroft sets down now to set forth rules for the King James translators, had there already been some precedent in the Anglican Church for doing something similar with this bishop's Bible? So, in the sense of having rules to govern the project, and in the sense of dividing the project up into sections, the bishop's Bible, you could argue, kind of set some precedences that would then be followed later on by the process that was employed by the King James translators. And I hate to say it that way. The translators did not come up with that process on their own. The Archbishop and King James did, and then they said to the translators, this is the process you need to follow. Okay? So, Parker's project was similar to one that Archbishop Cranmer had proposed many years prior, i.e. revision of the Great Bible by Anglican bishops. Regarding the matter, Condon writes, quote, Parker's plan for revising the Bible was the same as attempted by Archbishop Cranmer, in which Parker was more successful, since the clergy are now in sympathy with the English scriptures as they were not in Cranmer's time. So there's been a change, at least in terms of that. So the bishop's Bible was to be a revision of Cranmer's edition of the Great Bible from 1540. Quote, Cranmer's Bible 1540 was chosen as the basis of the revision. While it was the accepted version of the English Church, yet it was so inferior to the Genevan Bible that it was unacceptable to many who were prominent in the Episcopal Party. Complaints were made even before the issue of the Geneva Bible against Cranmer's version, although at the same time it was admitted that as a version it was nearer the Hebrew than the translation ascribed to Jerome. Parker's first rule for the guidance of the revisers was, we already said, to follow the common English translation used in the churches, which means they're going to follow the Great Bible. Okay, so go to page 7. Included in the material dated October 5, 1568, that Parker sent to Cecil was a letter to Queen Elizabeth from the Archbishop. Mombert reproduced the letter as follows on page 270. So let's read what he says. So this is Parker addressing who? The Queen, Queen Elizabeth. Among diverse observations, so this is what we're quoting here. So if you're following in the notes, we are on page 7, and we are in this box right here on page 7. So this is a screenshot from page 270 of Mombert's book. Among diverse observations which have been regarded is the recognition one was not to make it vary much from the translation which was commonly used by the public order, except where either the verity of the Hebrew and Greek moved alteration, or where the text was by some negligence mutilated from the original. So that I trust your loving subjects shall see good cause in your majesty's days to thank God and to rejoice to see this high treasure of his holy word, to set out as many as be proved, for far, far forth as man's mortal knowledge can attain unto, or as far forth as God hath hitherto revealed, to be faithfully handled in the vulgar tongue, beseeching your highness, now here's the important part, beseeching your highness that it may have your gracious favor, license, and protection to be communicated abroad, as well as for that in many churches that want their books and have long time looked for this, and for that in certain places be publicly used some translations which have not been labored in your realm. That's a slam on what? That's a slam on the Geneva Bible, because the Geneva Bible wasn't produced in England. It was produced where? Switzerland. Having inspired diverse prejudicial notes, which might have been also well spared, I have been bold in the furniture with few words to express the incomparable value of this treasure. Okay? So a couple things to point out there. Number one, is he wanting the queen? Notice like six lines up on the left. Is he wanting the queen's gracious favor, license, and protection of the bishop's Bible? Yes. Is he clearly presenting it as a replacement to the Geneva Bible, which was made outside of her realm and which contained prejudicial notes? Yes. Despite the Archbishop's request that Elizabeth license the new Bible, official royal sanction would not be forthcoming. That said, the volume was received and endorsed by ecclesiastical authorities, i.e. the bishops of the Anglican Church. So, did the Queen ever officially license and sanction the bishop's Bible?
No.
Her not doing that, was it consistent with her idea of this middle way between the Anglicans and the Puritans? If she comes out now and officially gives her royal sanction and license to the bishop's Bible, is that contrary to her idea of trying to, walk this middle path between the two, competing parties at that time? So consider the following citation from the pen of Mombert and Brake. That should say pen, I think, of Mombert and Brake. Look at the first one from Mombert. It is vain to speculate on the reasons why the royal authority was not accorded to the bishop's Bible, which not until 1577 was set forth by authoritative, i.e. episcopal authority. So did any monarch in England ever royally sanction it? Did the high church bishop sanction it? Yes. And then second, although the bishop's Bible was never officially licensed as the authorized Bible, the church and state enthusiastically received it. Clearly superior to the Great Bible, its actual translation fell short of the quality and simplicity of the Geneva translation. It never gained the popular support that many hoped that it would. So, what do we have now? After the Bishop's Bible, do we now have two competing Bibles? The Geneva Bible is the Bible of the people. It's the Bible of the Puritan faction and the Protestants, the sort of more aggressive Protestants. And then you have the Bishop's Bible now, which is the Bible of the High Church Anglicans, and the Bible that is going to be used now in the public reading in church, thereby replacing the Great Bible. Dr. Brake concludes his comments on the Bishop's Bible with the following paragraph, quote, "Fear seems to have prevented a truly revised text that conformed to standard language of the day." Now, let me just stop there. What does that mean? That means that they retain all the old forms of speaking. Like the extended verb endings, ETH, loveth, feareth, bringeth, all that stuff, right? They kept all that stuff in it. The Bishop's Bible was no more than a slight revision of the Great Bible. Parker's theological persuasion meant that he refused to acknowledge superior readings from the Genevan text. Even with all its faults, many editions of the Bishop's Bible published from 1568 to 1602 were published from 1568 to 1602. Yet it was not a Bible for the people, but rather for continued theological debate. Its primary influence came when it was selected by the King James translators to be the standard version to be followed in the new translation. And then I have a little bracketed note there stating that it was King James and Bishop Bancroft that established Rule 1, not the King James translators themselves. So, I think we could say the following and be pretty accurate in doing it. If it weren't for the fact that the King James translators that Bishop Bancroft said that the King James translators should follow the Bishop's Bible unless the truth of the original determined otherwise, the Bishop's Bible may, in fact, have been totally obscured because it was not necessarily used by the average English-speaking person of the day. It was reserved to the high church politics of the Anglican Church. Okay? So, we have a few minutes if there's any questions, but that brings us to the end of the prepared section of the notes. Does anybody have any questions about anything raised by this particular lesson?
Do you think the common man didn't like it so much and didn't accept it because of the lack of the notes and lack of...
I think that's part of it.
Or the way it was translated.
I think it was both.
Yeah.
I think it was both. I think they liked the notes in the Geneva Bible, especially all of these Puritans who were fundamentally very Calvinistic. So that's a factor, as is the fact that Geneva is just a better translation than the Bishop's. And we'll look at some examples of that next week when we look and talk about the Old Testament. Well,
I think you kind of answered my question. I was going to ask there's a couple of references to the Geneva being superior, and I was just going to ask if that was the translations that generally made it so.
So, the text of the Geneva, not the marginal notes, the text of the Geneva, especially in the Old Testament, was hands down better than the Bishop's Bible. And the reason why the Old Testament becomes a big factor in all of this is because had William Tyndale already finished the New Testament? So remember, when the bishops sit down to revise the New Testament that they're revising is the Great Bible. The Great Bible was a revision of the Matthew's Bible. And the Matthew's Bible basically reprinted the 1535 Tyndale New Testament. Right? But we know that Tyndale didn't finish the Old Testament before he was executed. So the rest of the Old Testament was finished originally by Coverdale using Latin, German, French, and other sources. It was not until you got to the Geneva Bible that the Old Testament, the rest of the Old Testament, was translated directly out of Hebrew into English, following a lot of the same structure and procedure that Tyndale had used. So the Geneva Bible in the Old Testament is hands down better than the Old Testament in the Bishop's Bible. And when we look at the times and the places where the King James translators altered the Old Testament text, the majority of the time, not all the time, but the majority of the time that they're altering the Old Testament text from the Bishop's Bible, they are often making it very similar to the Geneva Bible in those places. So the whole thing is it's very interesting, but it's also very sort of, you can't just, you know, wave a magic wand and make like blanket statements about all this stuff as though they would, you know, apply across the board in every case. You almost have to go instance by instance. So that's why, you remember last Sunday when I showed you the picture of the Old Testament from Judges chapter 7, was it Judges? I can't remember, no. 2 Samuel? I don't remember. But I showed you the picture from the 1602 bishops with the lines crossed out. Mm-hmm. And then I showed you how that's basically the text that ended up in the King James. Remember that? Mm-hmm. Well, if you take what they crossed out, and you compare what the final King James text was, it's going to have more in common in that verse with the Geneva, probably, than it will anything else. You follow what I'm saying? So that's just an illustration. I'm not saying you or anyone watching this, don't take that as like a hard and fast rule. I'm just trying to give you a general sense of what was going on.
Yeah.
Okay. Any other questions? So next Sunday what we're going to do is we're going to look specifically at the Old Testament of the bishops. And we'll make some comparisons between what the Great Bible had, what the Geneva Bible had, and then what the Bishop's Bible ultimately had in some of these spots. And then we'll look at the New Testament, and I'll probably do one lesson then on like just the bishops itself, what's included in the bishops, etc., and then we'll move on and talk about the reigns. Which is going to get everybody upset, but we'll talk about the reading. All right, any other questions? All right, appreciate your